The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Chairs Just Don't Float Around by Daniel Rogers. We sent Tanbit to play Flak Florm and sniff out the traitor, but he got kidnapped instead. Now we know why they kept inviting Tanbit to play Flak Florm, Alora said. It's my fault, Captain Kleber said. I gave them exactly what they needed. Don't be so hard on yourself, I said. No one could have guessed what they had in mind. Kleber pounded his fists on the table. I should have. It's my job to know. No, it's your job to respond. You can't predict the future. So how are we going to deal with the traitors and get Tanbit back? I really hope he has a good plan because I'm fresh out. Kleber sat with his eyebrow raised, a very good sign. He thinks best with a raised eyebrow. He only sat still for a moment before jumping to the computer. We can track Tambit's security card. Maybe it will give us a clue to the traitor's plans. He thumbed through holographic files, pulled one to the front, and skimmed through. They have weapons, Kleber said. Only Captain Kleber, his first officer, and Tanbit have security cards that can access the weapons vault. They planned on kidnapping Tanbit all along. A food replicator and a tool replicator. Needing food is obvious, and I suppose they thought it prudent to make tools if needed. They also took some delanium, Kleber said with a puzzled look. Why would they take delanium? I asked. No idea, Kleber said. Maybe they're planning on making something that needs power. Kleber slid the file away and reached for the weapons control application. He moved through several dials. Here we go. Kleber found a dial with five settings. Kill, maim, hurt, make them wish they had listened, and stun. He twisted his wrist and selected sun. I bet they don't know about this. Alora studied the holographs for a split second. Nice, a master override setting for all your weapons. Brilliant. I can't believe I need to use it. His men's betrayal pained Kleber, and it pained me to see him so pained. What do we know? Alora asked. Not much more than we knew before, Kleber paced. Wait a minute, I said. They're the ones who gave Targan the magnetic disruptor. If we find Targan, I bet we find them. Kleber and Alora agreed. Unfortunately, Kleber still refused to go down to the surface. He would not break the law, no matter what the situation. We thought you might say that, Alora said. We brought you a chameleon suit. The Talmarians never developed chameleon suits, and Kleber didn't understand what Alora offered. No offense, but I'm fine with the clothes I have. It works like a chameleon shield, except better. You'll practically be invisible, Alora said. He tried it on, and it worked perfectly. Well then, let's get those backstabbing pieces of broken glass, Kleber said with more vigor than I thought possible. I'm sorry you had to hear that, Alora. I'm just really mad. I understand, Alora said to Kleber. She turned to me and whispered, Was that cussing? I think so, I whispered back. I led the way down the ladder with Alora and Kleber following in their activated chameleon suits. The priests guarding the ladder are very familiar with me going up and down, but they wouldn't be so happy if they saw an entire party. We found Targan where we left him, at his home, except this time the traitors accompanied him instead of his elite guard. Alora snuck up to the kitchen window, eavesdropping on their conversation. She returned with disturbing news. Your men promised Targan advanced weapons in exchange for his help. That explains the tool replicator. And at this very moment, the elite guard are looking for something your men want very badly, but they haven't said what it is, Alora said. Whatever it is, it's the key to their whole plan, I said. We've got to make sure they don't get it. How can we keep them from it if we don't know what it is? Kleber asked. Well, we know they are looking for it and need to do whatever it is they intend to do. We simply eliminate anything they're not looking for, they don't need, and won't help them with their unknown plan. You're using words, but you need serious help. Kleber looked to Alora for support. Alora shrugged. Agree. But I've known that since the first day I met him. You get used to him. We voted to hide out until the elite guard returned, which turned out to be shorter than we thought. Two elite guardsmen entered the house. Alora quickly positioned herself outside the window again. She returned after a half hour. They haven't found it, but whatever it is, it's somewhere outside the city. That helps a little, I said. Alora and Kleber stared at me in utter disbelief. How, they asked. It eliminates the city. Yeah, but it includes the entire planet, Alora said. I see your point. I was just trying to be positive. Since we failed to discover the traitor's plans, we decided to at least attempt to rescue Tanbit. We discussed attacking, but thought better of it. Five guns against three felt like a losing gamble. Going back to the temple to enlist the Nockwalks would take too long. We ended up going with Alora. She noticed Tanbit tied to a chair near the window. Kleber would make a distraction by throwing a vase we found outside Targan's house through the living room window. When Targan and the traitors went to investigate, Alora would pull Tanbit out the window, chair and all. Kleber threw the vase. Alora waited until everyone left the kitchen, then grabbed Tanbit's chair with him in it. We ran through the streets to the temple, trying not to be seen. Unfortunately, we found out later that several ladies fainted when they saw a man running from a floating chair with a man tied to it. They told others the chair was trying to tie up another victim. We made it to the temple and explained to Bob that there might be a few extra gods staying the night. He handled the news well enough and pointed to the guest quarters. I would have loved to see the look on the traitors' faces when they returned to the kitchen to see their prisoner gone, but it's a small victory. I wish Tanbit knew what they were looking for, but they never mentioned it in his presence. There has to be a way to find out what it is before they find it and use it to carry out their plan. I just can't see it. The Trial by Mirror Lake. Fire engulfs the storage chamber. Shadows dance on the cave wall. Sage stares into the flames, counting the seconds before the chamber walls would give in. Time dilates into 1,000. Her brain pal, Teddy, switches to data mode. The nanochip implant lodged in her skull has been Sage's best friend since her 5th birthday. They don't need words to communicate. Video feeds and vital readings from inside the chamber rush to her occipital cortex. Electrons become information. She could see the cryogenic storage tank housing 5,000 human embryos. Inside the tank, liquid nitrogen holds storage temperature at 196 centigrade for now. Principal Hobbs, the robot headmaster conducting the trial, raises his alloy hand. Bring the embryos to safety. Go. Data stream stops. Sage needs no reminder for the obvious. Principal Hobbs runs a tight vault. Every 15-year-old, and that means everyone in her class, must go through the trial. At the end of the three-day exercise, Hobbs will assign each student to a track: officer, warrior, and artisan. The assignment is absolute. Hobbs mentioned something about survival of the vault, and that was that. Sage unplugs the oxygen canister from her hazmat suit and runs towards the fire. It's dead weight when there's no time to breathe. Embryos are irreplaceable. She must retrieve the tank before it is compromised. Heat seeps through her suit with a choking stickiness. Sage reminds herself, 2 minutes to get the tank out, 3 minutes before asphyxia. Stay calm. With her back against the melting door, Sage gives it a solid nudge. Fiery tongues follow her into the unlit space, halted for a second by the cold air inside. Sage darts inside and reaches for the tank. A shadow twitches behind the tank, a blind spot on the video feed. Sage's heart sinks. She hates surprises. Borrowing light from the fire, she recognizes a damaged hazmat suit curled up on the floor. The figure let out a faint sigh and stopped moving. 90 seconds. Fudge. With built-in wheels, cryo storage tank weighs a manageable 200 kilograms. Sage has 30 seconds to push it to safety. She could then return to help the figure on the floor. The math is easy. 5,000 is bigger than one. Sage steps around the motionless figure to get a firm grip of the tank. Despite the rising temperature, a chill crawls up her spine. The tank rolled reluctantly towards the door. Her heartbeat gets louder. The world disappears until all that's left is the weight of the tank in front of her. One Mississippi, two Mississippi. Sage loses count of time as her field of vision fogs up. Is she far enough away from the fire? She can almost feel Teddy's buzz. Time, the principal's metallic voice tears through the fog. Sage peels off the suit and takes in a deep breath. Her feet can't seem to find balance. Fire recedes to the safety pilot. The cave starts to reset for the next trial. I saw a damaged suit. Someone's inside. It was an illusion, part of the test. Hobbs was ready to call the next student. What? Sage wants to shout but holds back. This too is probably part of the test. Trial by fire is not just about courage. Anyone can repeat the motions. Most will follow orders. An officer is responsible for the whole group. They need to make tough decisions under pressure. Hobbs stares directly at Sage, his tone flat as ever. Sage clenches her teeth. The principal is always right. She decides to push her luck. Principal Hobbs, is everything part of a program? In my case, yes, if the objective is clear, I just need you to optimize for the conditions. Hobbs needs a tune-up soon. The last 15 years have caused more wear and tear to his neural network than the previous 1,000. Ever since the children started talking, he's been burning through nuclear fuel cells like there's no tomorrow. If only his job were simpler, like surviving a tsunami or an earthquake. What about me? Sage follows. Biological humans don't follow programs in the same way. You are more... Hobbs pauses as if searching for words. Random. What? Sage regrets it immediately. She knows what random means. It's a good thing. That's why each person is unique, even clones. Hobbs stops mid-sentence and stands up. I'm boring you. You did well. Run along and enjoy your free time. Hobbs presses a button to open the airlock. Sage catches a glimpse of the Hobbs back as she walks out. Is the robot slouching? She'd be tired if she's running on a 1,000-year-old program. Carved deep into the bedrocks of Svalbard Island, Paradise Vault is a backup plan for life on Earth. Its mainframe computer hosts a digital knowledge archive, the last relic of the Eden era. The Doomsday facility houses over 10 million biological samples of plants and animals. more precious of all, are the 100,000 human embryos, a.k.a. the seeds. In 2148, a comet the size of Rhode Island hit Earth, making the planet uninhabitable. Spaceships launched in all directions, searching for the next colony in the stars. Hobbs' crew were left behind to wait for the right conditions to wake up the seeds. 15 years ago, the Awakening program was triggered. Now there are 99,700 embryos and 300 teenagers, including Sage. An escape tunnel leads back to the safety and comfort of the living quarters of Paradise Vault. The bare-bone design of the tunnel also ensures complete insulation from the hazardous conditions of the trial cave. Sage likes the quietness. It felt wrong. Only Teddy can hear her thoughts. For a robot, Hobbs can be mean, Teddy quotes 5-year-old Sage. That's a puts a smile on Sage's face. It's easier said than done. Greatest good for greatest number. Are we all just numbers? Sorry, Sage, I can't access the mainframe to get you an answer now, Teddy apologizes. Sage continues, what am I supposed to do? You do what you can. Teddy doesn't need the mainframe for the answer. From Rot to Rebirth by Marissa Herzberg. Fresh air seeps through the slowly opening petals of my ephite cradle. For the first time in this new life, I feel cool and thick air on my cheeks. This cradle has incubated me from a seed of magic. I was in the lights without purpose until the hum from Oral Lithra, guardian and light of all, whisked what I am into this cradle. I attempt to open my eyes to no avail. The lingering sleep is heavy. I feel as if I was tucked into a cozy cocoon with weights strapped to my eyes, arms, and legs. Instead of sight, I compromise with my sluggish body and opt to wiggle my fingers. Even these small movements further stimulate the petals to open. My cradle knows that it's time to bloom. A gentle caress of magic wraps around my delicate body. I am left with a soothing reminder. I am not alone. Aura Lithra gives me her full attention as I wake from the rest between rot and life. The deep rebirth slumber I am waking from has not yet released my body from its grip. I attempt to burrow lower to rest just a few moments longer. Attempt failed. The cradle tightens around me, then quickly releases, forcing a stretch that starts in my core, then springs in all directions. I feel every limb and muscle tighten as I reach the capacity of the ephite cradle. I'm pressed against the fleshy, thick petals that have protected me these past months. I attempt to wriggle my legs to find more room. They don't budge. Aural Thrilla has connected me directly to her. A euphoric wave washes over my entire body as the cradle loosens again, only this time more than the last. The once tightly sealed petals begin pulling away from each other. The bright sky above rests its rays upon my skin for the first time, blinding me. Simultaneously, an unexpected gust of cool air dances down my body. I feel myself come alive. In this one breath, I know my purpose. Pollution filter, water purifier, spore spreader, life giver. Aura Lithra pours information into me. The same radiating light enters my once dark chamber. I wince away from the overwhelming sensations. There is too much change, too fast, in less than a heartbeat. Aura Lithra sends another wave of euphoria down our bond. The reminder of her presence grounds me. The panic slows, and I am able to enjoy the tingling warmth that dances across my newly grown skin. Sun, Aralithra relays. Nourishment, she continues. The once silent magic surrounding me tickles with vibration as her hums fills my senses. Moments pass as the cradle's custody of my mind and body begins to fade. Soon the wiggle in my fingers evolves. My muscles loosen as I fully wake from the lingering sleep. Alert and feeling the need to continue filling my lungs, my arms reach above my head. The petals above fold outward over one another. I allow my fingers to peek out of the damp petals and find the breeze. Unlike the newly discovered polluted wind, the beating rays of the sun are hot. The cool breeze that once danced from my scalp down to my ankles has passed, leaving only quickly disappearing chills. My eyes flutter open, then close. This pattern between blurry vision, new colors, then darkness continues as they adjust to the light. This realm is much brighter than the last few I have healed, populated, and reformed. I now understand my purpose. I am on Earth. It was suffocated by its previous inhabitants. I am the filtration this dying planet needs to be restored. The cradle that has been inching its way open, exposing me to the decay around me, drops me. In a sea of browns, yellows, green, reds, and gray, my back hits the ground in a heavy thud. The impact forces the last of the liquid from my lungs out. The soft hum, Aralithra, grows louder and consistent. Her magic flows into me. I feel the roots connecting me to her throbbing power, heating beneath my skin. Pure, beautiful power. The roots that swallow my legs into the earth are the most efficient way to gain the knowledge needed to assist this dying world. When the roots wither and disconnect, I will have been given all of the information needed for my purpose. However, this feels different. The heat in my legs is uncomfortable and growing hotter. Moisture on my skin begins to sizzle. The burning turns to scorching. The scorching turns into blinding pain that leads to a deafening sound. Your voice. All will be well, Aralithra assures. She sends another dose of euphoria. It burns off. The deafening sound won't stop, and there is a ripping inside of my throat. Raw. The pain is raw. I thrash. Make it stop. Aralithra's magic surrounds me in an attempt to comfort. Make it stop, in a thunderous shriek. The euphoria is back in unending waves, growing until I feel nothing. The world goes black. When I wake, my eyes focus on the colors dancing behind the nearest translucent cloud cover above, where her shimmering power is. The colorful lights in an otherwise dark sky follow. Aurora Borealis, Aralithra corrects. Motionless, I ignore her. If I reach for her shimmering magic until the dull ache in my head evolve into familiar scalding the darkness helped me escape from. Her power dances up my legs, weaving through my thighs, then windles through curves of my body. She caresses my cheek. It was necessary, Ephyra. The light behind the clouds dances wildly, the colors of her swirling in a rainbow of colors, ranging from whites to purples. I soften with each performance she shares. Chancing the pain, I take in my surroundings, noticing the glow of Ephite cradles, their cradles glowing with a soft luminescence, life sprouting out from their cradles in an otherwise dead world. A comfort washes over me. Ephites are not solitary beings. We depend on each other. Our bodies are tailored to the specific needs Aralithra has designed us. Our bodies are also tailored to complement each other's gifts and purpose. There isn't an Ephite you could introduce me to that I do not already know. We are connected. Our Olithra will ask us individually if we would like to continue on to our next life, our next mission. It's rare an Ephite stays behind. We are a community. I notice movement in a few nearby cradles. I wonder if our Olithra dances for them as well. My eyes close and I allow myself to ground in memories of past lives, simpler lives. My mind wanders to the realm before this one, Ketunamia, a simple and meaningful existence. Unlike the many moving limbs I acquired in this new life, I was cylindrical, a body that gracefully lulled through the weeds, a mind without worry. I compare the two worlds as the sun is beginning to rise. Morning dew stains the nearby dead leaves, dampening the clearing. Our Olithra chose for us. I have been granted the names of trees, sky, sun, leaves, life, and Armadillidium vulgare. On the last one, I felt a shimmer of magic mocking the small oval creature before me. She must think I've forgiven her, that I'm no longer afraid. I look where her magic urges me to, and I watch as it struggles through. Our Olithra's bond glitters, no doubt hoping I'll finally respond to her. Roly-poly, our Olithra delights. I watch it for a long while, crawling under leaves and twigs, worrying that it may be too light to survive the weight its surroundings. I remove a leaf from above Armadillidium vulgare, or roly-poly, to test my strength. The leaf weight is nothing between my fingers. It crumbles. I gasp. Do I have incredible strength? I think towards our bond. She ignores me. You insist on having my attention, then do not respond. Our bond shimmers. Speak, she insists. I have spoken now several times. Out loud, wise one. My question remains. I clear my throat, then continue. Have I harmed the tree star? How will my strength aid in healing this place? You are strong in many ways, Ephira. However, physical strength is not necessarily one of them. You will need strength in many areas of your mind and heart for the task I have for you. The hum of her magic steady as she responds. Do I lack physical strength, I inquire? No. Your strength is adequate, she insists. Satisfied with my strength, I drop the star-shaped leaf, then carefully pinch at the small creature. It is bigger than a grain of rice and smaller than a sunflower seed. Our Olithra flashes images of each item as I learn to recognize the information she has already shared with me. I count out 7 sets of legs and admire its hard, dark armor. The Armadillidium vulgare armor shields its white underbelly, she chimes. A cradle dropping open startles me, and I flinch hard, nearly dropping the wood lice. The many names creatures closes in on itself, becoming a ball, then rolling around my palm. I'm sorry, I whisper to the frightened creature. I allow it to roll out of my hand and back to the moist soil beneath us. Moved my hand away from it, I feel guilty that I had disturbed it. Forgive me, rolling creature. I'm here to heal your home. An overwhelming sensation grows in my chest. You're giving an apology. You feel empathy. I take a mental note of her explanation. Our Olithra will be guiding my mind as I adjust to this new world. This place is so different, so complex. I let my mind roam again to a simpler life. Ketunamia has no sounds, or if there is sound, it was unknown to me. I had no holes in my head to receive this new sensation, as I do now. My hands, each to each side of my face, exploring. I compare this body to my previous ones, taking long moments to examine how it bends and curls at my will, instead of one solid body that would gracefully lull through the weeds. This body splits off from itself, all parts able to move independently. How will I dig or crawl beneath the leaves? I find it difficult to relate this body to the roly thing. This may be the first body our erythra has grown for me that does not resemble the creature I am here to save. The last memory I have of Ketunamia is weaving through the colorful weeds and flicking my tongue as I hunted the rich smell of magic. I could feel the gentle hum of Mother calling me, warning me that my time healing Ketunamia, land of serpents, could be at an end. I had a choice to stay and make my snake-like body my last life. It was a beautiful life, almost fulfilling. I paused, considering continuing to help the native population increase and immerse myself in their culture. The serpents were kind, slow living beings that existed solely to continue life, slithering through the grass, breeding, warming my eggs, then releasing that body's children. Ketunamia was comforting, simple. However, it was an easy choice. I knew I would miss the neon moon that never left the sky, but it was not my home. I answered the quiet call for a change. In a few heartbeats, my serpentine body died, dissolving into the weeds. I gave back what I had taken from the land, then went into a deep rest. I am not made aware of how long I lay resting in the start with Aurelithra, only that inevitably she will pace me. The first few days of new life are disorienting and full of wonder. Every sound, smell, and feeling in this unpredictable body send my mind into a frenzy. I spend a majority of that time sorting and organizing every bit of knowledge that is thrusted upon me. Newly out of a deep magic-induced rest, the words come slowly, then all at once. Names, smells, images of this new land slam into me unannounced. Everything I see has a title. Every sound has a cause. Even the sensation I feel that makes the air feel scarce and thin has a title, is a feeling. Overwhelmed, I attempt to ground myself through the dizziness. I focus on the memory of the tiny roly-poly that once traced the deep line in my palm. Usually focusing on the primary living being, I am there to heal or save roots deeper into the magic. Easing the discomfort, unfortunately, with this realm's roly being the discomfort in my mind and body only grows. I feel pressure of shimmering magic at the back of my mind. I ignore it. I refuse to accept more information until what I've gathered has settled. My head throbs as I sit up. A painful discomfort spreads down my spine from being in the same position for so long. My feet are still rooted into the soil. I attempt gently tugging them from the solid ground. Not much more happens than detaching a few of the dried-out roots, lines to our bond and her magic that I no longer need. Once all of the information has been given, all of the roots will wither and detach. Relief surrounds me. With each root that releases the hold from Aurelithra is weaker. It slows the rate information it's fed to me. My mind slows a little and the air thickens again. My head falls into my arms between my raised knees. My eyes close. I ground myself one last time on words full of clear purpose and creatures. No emotions, nausea, dizziness, or grounding to receive never-ending information. Ketunamia translates roughly to rainbow grass, a very fitting name for the vibrantly colorful world. Although the beautiful tall weeds and flowers were enough to steal your breath, nothing compared to the neon moon that changed color according to weather and time, never setting. It was not made of rock or gas, but a rare bioluminescent liquid. The snake-like beings that slithered the rainbow lands nearly met extinction. A virus swept through their population, killing every female the realm had. Aurelthera heard their pleas and felt their mourning. Not long after, I was called to leave or choose the life I was living before Ketaminia. As I've responded to her in every life I have lived, I answered her call for change. Then I allowed that body to dissolve. My purpose was to give life. So I did. I gave the land of rainbow grass 2,732 offspring before leaving. I wonder what I will offer this new world, what Aurelithra has designed my new curvaceous form to do for this place. In every life, my form has been rescue-specific. My purpose in each realm has always been clear, or at least it was until this one. Arch, skin, filters, cap, pores. Aurelithra slips in through a crack of our bond. I slam it closed. What was I made for? How can I use this body to heal this place? What needs to be healed? Where did my poly creature go? My head throbs. I feel her prying the bond open. In frustration, I crack open the bond. Her energy barreling in as if it was all accumulating and waiting, sending a rush through my system. Where am I? I imagine throwing the question at her instead of to her, hoping she understands the intent. Earth. The name echoes in my mind. In shock, I fully open my mind. Tell me more, I plead mentally. Without warning, she drowns my mind in information for a few heartbeats, then slams the beautiful place where her magic flows from shut. My mind goes silent. The headache eases a bit, and the last roots holding me to this place release. Without the tension of the roots holding my feet in place, I fly back. I land hard on the dried petals that once held my body in a cocoon. Without life pulsing through them, I now know the petals were never petals. They appeared to be some sort of mushroom. Spores swirl in the air, temporarily blinding my vision. I waited for the white and light pink spores to settle. As my vision cleared, beyond my immediate colorful world, I noticed a change. Most of the greens fade to brown. The vibrant grass and moss dwindle to dying weeds, and the merciful shade from trees towering above is missing. I search the archives of my mind for answers. I am on Earth. Earth is dying, if not already dead. How do I help the roly-poly? How can I save the easily hidden oval-crawling creature and its Earth? I feel a gentle wave of magic from beneath me crawling up my body as it filters into my mind one last time. Aurelithra sends images, sounds, directions, details of my anatomy, my mission, and one last image that she lingered on much longer than the others. It looks so much like the reflection the water held for me. Human. Male. Green eyes. Hair. Skinny. Starving. Then flashes of what used to be, what could be again if I choose to stay, and love this realm, no planet. Red cheeks, plump, health, food in the plants, food in the water, food on the land, food flying in the sky. Food is in almost everything on this planet. The bushes, trees, squirrels, ground, a frog eating a roly-poly. Aurelithra, I shout, then grab my throat in surprise. Don't be distracted. You are on Earth for the humans. Be careful, this world is suffering from famine. Everything and everyone is on the food chain, she warns. Her reassuring presence leaves, and I patiently explore our surroundings while waiting for the other cradles to awaken. The strangest thing happened. I can't get those green eyes out of my mind. Where I End, I Begin by Dasha Babenets. I woke up to the sound of shelling. It had become my usual morning routine. The same way my hair felt heavy and greasy now under the helmet I never took off. I was transferred to the Eastern Front Line not long ago, but I've already learned that if I had to sum up war, it would be mud. Mud everywhere, on the tip of my tongue, in my nostrils, in the back of my throat. I never thought I could hate that earthy taste so much, but it makes sense. My whole day is spent hiding in it, sleeping in it, eating with hands already caked in it, simply living inside it. I've always been slow to wake up, but now mornings have become a greater torture than night duty or attacks, mostly because I no longer have a reason to wake up. What I would give for a clean shirt and a cup of strong coffee from the cafe near my Aunt Agnes's apartment. The coffee there was extraordinary, bitter and sharp. Funny how the earth tastes the same now. I come to my senses and realize my knee is still aching. I should go see Anna. For the last 6 months, she's been the only person here who speaks softly. Sometimes I exaggerated my symptoms just to talk to her and to treat myself to the sugary caramel candies she made over the fire, letting sugar slowly bubble and darken in a spoon, as if she was always too busy to care about doing it properly. Thinking about how she would react to my whining today, I barely noticed myself reaching the medical tent where half our brigade was already gathered. I stood staring at the ugly clock hanging inside the tent until the other hut nurse, Mary, finally noticed me. "Soldier Renati, is there anything I can help you with?" "My knee hurts like hell. I was wondering if some morphine might help." She raised an eyebrow. "No offense, but you got a horse dose last night. Let's see how it feels in a few hours." She looked at me like she already knew why I had really come there. "It's better not to argue with old Mary unless you want the entire medical unit against you." I left the tent, muttering, "Feels like it already wore off." I know it's pointless to beg them. They have their own protocols they have to follow. I'm walking through scorched earth, and out of the corner of my eye, I notice something strange. Strange because there's almost no greenery in our area, yet there's a small patch of grass, as if a dandelion managed to break through the cement. "God, is that you? I haven't seen the gifts of the earth in so long, haven't been charmed by birds singing or the sound of a stream. My music has become bursts of gunfire and the whistle of artillery shells." I turn my head and see a small plantain bush quietly spreading its leaves, as if trying to pretend it's a water lily. My mom used to tell me as a child that plantain could heal any wound. Funny, right? Even as I've grown hardened, something in me still wants to try it. I pick a small leaf and return to my trench. I stare at it for a long time. It seems much more alive than me. Straightening and smoothing it out, I carefully press it against my knee. Today we only watch the enemy positions and wait. Strange how easily the word enemy became natural. Men I had never met before had somehow become less than human in my mind. My knee throbbed again. I took a slow breath. A few years ago, back when I was still a graduate student, my professor used to speak endlessly about pain and breathing. We studied physics, but he treated every lecture like philosophy. He once told us the body panics before the mind does. "Breathe first," he said, tapping cigarette ash into a coffee cup. "Then decide whether you're dying." At the time, I thought he was insane. Now I realize he was probably just a smart guy. Lying in a trench with a plantain leaf pressed against my knee, I noticed the pain had actually begun to fade. Tonight I'm assigned to a night raid, so they ordered me to sleep a bit while the others watched the position. I swear I only closed my eyes for a moment. When I opened them again, the trench was gone. The mud beneath my boots had turned into black and white tile flooring, stained with water and ash. Somewhere above me, pipes groaned like wounded animals. A dim yellow light flickered overhead. My knee no longer hurt. I looked around slowly and wandered the hall. Rows of strange machines stretched across the room, coils of copper wire, glass cylinders bubbling with dark liquid, enormous steel devices covered in dials and handwritten calculations. The air smelled of iodine, smoke, and burnt metal. Then I saw him. Professor? He stood beside a massive apparatus that looked half medical instrument, half artillery cannon. His great coat hung from his shoulders exactly the same way it had back at the university. You're late, he said calmly without turning around. A radio cracked somewhere in the distance. For a moment, I thought I heard artillery again, but the explosion sounded distant now, as if the war itself had sunk underwater. What is this place? I asked. The professor ignored the question. Instead, he pointed toward a wall covered in equations and anatomical sketches pinned together with photographs of wounded soldiers. In the middle of the wall, written in thick red paint, were the words, "Being a soldier is like being a phoenix. You die and get reborn all over again." The letters looked wet, as if they had just been painted. I stepped closer. Among the papers, I suddenly recognized my own handwriting. The professor finally turned toward me. His face looked older than I remembered. "War accelerates transformation," he said quietly. "A man rarely survives it as himself." The machine behind him began to hum louder. Then I noticed the glass chambers. Inside each one stood another version of me, a university student clutching physics books, a bloodied soldier, half his face lost to ruin, an old man with hollow eyes, and in the final chamber, only ashes. The machine suddenly roared to life. Then the ashes moved. At first only slightly, as if disturbed by the wind, but there was no wind in the laboratory. The gray pile trembled inside the glass chamber, folding inward and outward like something breathing beneath a blanket. I stumbled back. "Professor," my voice cracked, "what is this?" The old man watched the chamber silently, his face illuminated by the pale electrical glow. "The war," he said at last, "is teaching mankind something it was never meant to learn." The ashes begin to darken. Then slowly fingers emerged from them, human fingers. My stomach twisted. "No." The hand clawed weakly against the glass. More of the body followed, a wrist, ribs, the shape of a skull beneath thin skin, as though someone were developing a photograph too quickly. I wanted to look away, but I couldn't. The figure inside the chamber was me, not exactly me, older perhaps, thinner. Its body was covered in burns and black soot, yet its eyes were open long before the face had fully formed, and those eyes already recognized me. The professor approached the chamber carefully. "You asked me once," he murmured, "whether energy can ever truly disappear." I remembered the university lecture hall in winter, myself half asleep in a warm haze, while he smoked near the chalkboard and spoke about thermodynamics and the persistence of matter, as if the world itself was supposed to hold together because of it. "You said destruction was just transformation," I whispered. "Yes." The thing inside the chamber smiled. Its teeth were covered in ash. Outside the laboratory, air raid sirens began to howl. The lights flickered violently. The professor didn't look at me right away. He watched the wall of chambers instead, as if counting something that had gone wrong. "They're closer than expected," he said finally. "Who?" I asked. He hesitated. "That's not the important question." He rubbed his fingers together as if trying to wipe off invisible death. "Listen, Mr. Renati," his voice tightened slightly. "The Phoenix was never meant to return," he said quietly, "only to be remade." The glass began to crack, first one line, then another, then the entire wall of chambers fractured at once. Inside, the figures moved, not rushing, just stepping forward as if they had always been waiting for permission. Ash drifted through the air like slow snow. The burned version of me leaned closer to the broken glass. "You think war kills people?" it whispered. The professor finally looked at me as if noticing I was still there. "It changes what they are allowed to remain." The glass collapsed into a million small pieces, then the laboratory vanished. I woke, choking in the trench. My fingers dug deep into the muddy earth. For a moment I couldn't breathe. The night sky above me was endless and black, scattered with cold stars. I wondered if I could ever escape this hell and become something other than a part of this endless mud. Well, I can still breathe. For now, that feels like enough. The night air is cold and strangely clean after the shelling. It smells like burnt paper, the same paper I used to roll cigarettes with back at the university. Funny how even clean air reminds me of smoke now. I wondered how much ruined metal is sleeping beneath the soil already. Helmets, bullets, watches, teeth, whole men. The earth swallows everything eventually. Sometimes I think the weight of my rifle and grenades is nothing compared to what the ground itself carries. All this steel, all these bodies, all the things people tried to destroy each other with. Years from now, someone will still dig pieces of this war out of the dirt. Maybe a child will find a rusted shell where a plantain should have grown. Maybe that is how wars survive in the land itself. Being a soldier is like being Phoenix. You get hurt, you die, and you get reborn all over again. I'm not sure how many versions of me are already dead. The naive boy who thought life would treat him fairly. The unfinished scientist I once wanted to become. Or the hero who believed I could handle it all. Right now, I'm just a pile of ashes, not knowing what my next version will be. And yet ash is what remains after everything is gone. One day I will disappear too, and there may be no one left to tell what happened here, but the earth remembers what we forgot.